Welcome to Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost, here with you every weekday from 9 until 1, here on Share Radio on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. Now, the team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance section of the Mail Online, back in the studio for their weekly catch-up. And attempts to break the deadlock in the Greek debt crisis roll on, but European leaders could agree on a deal to start tackling the migrant crisis, and David Cameron laid down his demands for reforming the UK's role in the EU.
People always say to me these things aren't possible, you'll never get them done. Well, once again, we've proved we will get them done. We've started that process and it's underway.
Editor Simon Lambert and Lee Boyce will take us on a whistle-stop tour of Europe. Get your spare euros at the ready. We'll let you know why shortly. Plus, Simon Lee will be talking through some of the other stories that they've been investigating this week, including, is it goodbye to branches, hello to the bank in your pocket?
If we can enable you to do everything you need to do on your mobile device, frankly, just with your thumb, we can give you fantastic value products.
We discuss the newest kid on the banking block and why this could signal good news for savers. Also, get your head round the latest pension changes. More coming in next year on top of the freedoms that were introduced in April. Is the PensionWise service good enough for you? But then how much would or could you pay for professional advice? Well, a firm thinks they may have come up with a cheaper solution.
They'll walk you through what secure income you might need. So it's going to be much more personalised to you.
And why it's still worth haggling when buying a home, despite hunters facing the smallest cuts to asking prices in years. And we are also asking today. An Italian grandfather finally finished middle school at the tender age of 91 years old. The former tailor, Nicola Torello, got full marks in his maths exam and English speaking test and has now set his sights on studying at secondary school and wants to get a bit more familiar with technology. So, if you went back to education, what would you study? And it can be absolutely anything, not necessarily vocational, something creative perhaps, or not. A very warm welcome, Simon. Very warm welcome, Lee. Starting with you, Simon. If you could go back to education, let's be honest, we've all got about 60 years left in us here.
Well, morning. I think, do you know what I'd like to study? I'd like to study something like engineering. I'd like to be able to build stuff, proper stuff. I'd love to be able to take an engine apart and put an engine back together or something. I'd love to be able to, you know, just build something proper. Most of my studies were creative. I did English and I did philosophy at university and I did, you know, English and French and economics actually as an A-level. But actually, the other thing that I would study, and there's a cautionary tale here for kids, it's basically I was always very good at maths, but we did our maths GCSE a year early at school, so we did it in the fourth year rather than the fifth year. And then in the fifth year, you could either do some sort of DOSI thing if you didn't do very well at maths, or you did the first bit of a maths A-level. And I decided I didn't want to do a maths A-level, so I basically completely ignored that year, didn't want to do maths A-level, completely, you know, just failed to bother even really turning up. And actually, I should have done maths, should have continued with maths, because I was good at it. And that's there's a lesson there for any teenagers listening. Basically, if you are good at something, don't just think, oh, it's not cool, I'm not going to do it.
So basically, the editor of This Is Money is saying that you didn't go on and do maths at A-level because you couldn't be bothered. I'll say no more about that.
Do you know what I would have done? I probably would have done really well at it.
I doubt. Yeah. As you've proved through your very successful career dealing with numbers. Apologies, Simon. But before we go into engineering, perhaps go back and do the maths. So there you go.
Yeah, I think I'll probably have to do the maths first to get into the engineering. Yeah.
I reckon so. You, Lee?
Good morning.
Estate agency or...
Estate agency studies, no. if I could go back, I would like to learn a foreign language. Definitely. I think that is like the most important thing at the moment. And it's great to be able to go away and not go to France or Italy or something, just point at baguette, you know.
Nice.
Just, you know, I want to be able to have a conversation. Well, you know, it's not bad, but I was terrible at language at school. I don't think I have that part of the brain that sort of like lets me do it. Yeah. So I'd like to go back and give it a long old go. But that guy was 91. I mean, I've got plenty of time left.
You've got at least, I don't know, 70 years yet, Lee.
Well, maybe 3 months' time. Maybe I'll do it and I'll do one show here in some sort of language.
The great thing about learning a foreign language is that, yeah, you can be good at it or not. And I'm one of those lucky people who's all right with learning language. I don't have that fear of just saying something in the other language. But you can teach yourself. That is the great thing about it. And if you think about it, you know, people say, oh, I'm not good at languages. But there are Gaza can speak Italian. David Beckham can speak Spanish.
Oh, let's hope for
us all. You could learn. And actually, if you do try to learn, there's this guy who does these language courses called
Michelle Thomas. So good.
And he teaches it in the way that you actually want to use it. And I used it to learn some Italian. And it basically beats all other language learning, hands down.
Absolutely okay. Brilliant. No books involved. You just listen to it. I did it with German. But the problem is, though, with language learning, which one would you pick?
Yeah, that is the thing. I don't know which one I would pick. Which one sounds the best? I don't know. Like, it's just quite a romantic thing, isn't it? When you
Italian sounds good.
But it's only spoken in Italy, isn't it? That's trouble. It's quite useless.
Well, we could go on for ages on this.
Yeah, but then, why learn a language? Everyone speaks English.
Oh, there is that point as well.
In China.
Chinese.
Yeah. If you've got any suggestions for Lee, do let us know. Texas 66677 text must start with the word share. What language should Lee learn?
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie France. This is Share Radio on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning finance section of The Mail Online, join me in the studio for our weekly catch-up. And coming up with even more changes on the horizon for our pensions, how much would you pay to figure all your options out? But first, it's a big week for Europe. The Greek debt crisis rumbles on. Deal, no deal, deal, no deal. Well, we have to wait and see if Athens can strike a deal with creditors to meet a Tuesday deadline to pay €1.6 billion to the IMF. It comes as European leaders could agree to start tackling the migrant crisis, and David Cameron sets out his proposals to other European leaders in Brussels, firing the starting gun for the process of renegotiating the UK's membership of the EU.
Above all, I'm delighted that the process of British reform and renegotiation and the referendum that we're going to hold, that process is now properly underway. People always say to me these things aren't possible, you'll never get them done. Well, once again, we've proved we will get them done.
So, Simon Lee, firstly, the situation of a Brexit. What is a Brexit when it's at home? What does David Cameron want? What is he likely to achieve?
The Brexit would be Britain leaving the European Union, basically. We decide to take our ball and go home, basically, because we don't like how the game's being played. And that's what David Cameron's gone over to say, is that we don't like how this game's being played. And one of the core aims of the EU is basically this ever-closer union of the countries, which is where, actually, the concept of the Eurozone comes from, is it's pulling all the countries tighter and tighter together. And we in Britain don't particularly like that, and we'd like to have more sovereignty over our own decisions. And I don't think we're the only country that feel like that, actually, to be perfectly honest.
Is he likely to achieve this? What he's setting out to get?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he is basically walking up to them and saying, look, I know you've got this game and these are the rules, but we don't want to play by those rules. So we'd like an opt-out on that bit. I think, actually, Britain already has opted out of the core EU aim of ever closer union. We didn't join the Eurozone, and we've made it perfectly clear that we're not interested in that stuff. I mean, what we're more interested in is the concept of a free trade area, basically a place where you can trade with other countries without any tariffs or taxes, and it's easy to move things across borders. But we don't like the idea of political or monetary unity. I think to many in the grand European project, that looks a bit self-interested. I think there's an element of truth in it.
Not even that, but with the migrant crisis rolling on and the Greek situation, doesn't this all look a bit for David Cameron to go to Brussels and start asking about the UK's membership of the EU? A little bit, and I couldn't think of the word, but I said self-interest, selfish, a bit, you know, tactless at the moment when there are, let's be honest, bigger fish to fry right now?
I suppose, but there's never a good time to ask these kind of questions, is there, for him? He's got the pressures on. He's just, you know, he's won an election off the back of it. But I think that what we don't really understand sometimes in Britain is that actually, there is this real passion for this grand European project in Europe, and not just amongst the politicians, but amongst many of the people. If you speak to, you know, Germans, French people, they do have this desire for it. But obviously, parts of it, like the Eurozone and the Euro, aren't working. With the migrant crisis, I think, to be honest, actually most of Europe looks pretty self-interested because they're essentially turning around to Italy and going, oh, sorry, you're closest, it's your problem. Which I don't really think is the way to deal with it.
Well, let's touch on Greece. We have to. Rumbles on. Despite optimism at the start of the week, what is the latest, please? What are the sticking points?
Well, we sat here last week, last Friday, talking about whether Greece was going to leave the Euro last weekend with the sort of comment of it always happens at the weekend. They didn't leave the Euro last weekend. So will they leave this weekend?
Although they are having talks this weekend. So plausibly, it could happen.
Possibly. Although... Adrian Lowry, our assistant editor, he says end of July. And I think Adrian's got it on the money there.
Solid estimate, I think. But it's been a lot of stop-start this week, hasn't it, with Greece? Mm. 1 minute you think they've come with some sort of deal and some sort of arrangement and the terms look pretty good. It looks like it could be agreed. And then actually, you know, no, it's not good enough. You have to go back to the drawing board and you're back to zero. And, I mean, the FTSE this week's been up and down off the back of it as well because there's just so much uncertainty and no one quite knows what's going to happen. But we mentioned this last week. It's been dragging on for years. It's just been a real slow-burning process of what's going to happen next.
And do you know what apparently delayed it on Monday? Was on Sunday, the Greeks came up with this deal and they basically sent over the deal, but they sent over the wrong draft.
Yeah, which about sums it up, doesn't it? Well, just to highlight how long this Greek saga's been rumbling on, I'm waving in my hand a 20-euro note. It's not mine. I had to borrow it. That sounds familiar. On This Is Money, you've resurrected an article you wrote back in 2012, based, I believe, on an article that you wrote in 2010. Now, tell us a little bit more about this, if you would, Simon.
So this is how you find out where a euro note is from. Now, this is a trick that's not known to many people, but whilst the architects of the Great European Project would have you believe that all euros are created equal and are equal, actually there's a little letter on the note that tells you its country of origin. We mentioned this last week, actually, but I'd written something in 2012 about how you find out where a euro is from, talking about how it looked like Greece might finally about to be bundled out of the eurozone. And actually that was talking about something that I'd originally written in 2010 when this whole thing first kicked off. But readers love it, so I reflected on the fact that this was an illustration of the complete failure of the eurozone to deal with the problem because 5 years down the line it was still going on, but also explained how you can work out where your euros are from. So we have got euros in the studio for a real live euro test.
We've got euros aplenty, not because of me, but I'm just in front of you, Simon, is a wad of euros. Now, what's funny is neither of these euros or notes belong to either of us.
No,
we
no,
both
some of
them.
These are mine. Some of these are mine, but some of them are Mark Schoffman's, who I relieved of his euros yesterday afternoon.
You relieved a lot of euros off Mark Schoffman there. He's nervously waiting by his desk back at This Is Money, hoping you're going to return them. So let's find out then, how do we find out where they're from?
This is so exciting.
Lee, you've got the list, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got the list in front of me.
Georgie, do you want to go first?
All right, but I've only got one. That's
so there's
fair.
A letter at the front of the serial number, and that tells you what country it's from.
What do we not? We want Germany?
We don't want Greece.
Greece.
No, you want Greece.
Oh, we want Greece.
You want a hoarder.
Okay.
I don't know. Are we playing Top Trumps?
Yeah.
Top Trumps of Euro notes.
I've got...
There you go. There's some more for you.
Oh, great.
Drum roll.
I've got V.
That's from Spain.
Okay. Go, Simon.
I've got E.
That is from Slovakia.
Ooh.
That's interesting. I've got SD.
It's just the first letter that counts.
Sorry.
Italy.
Sorry.
S. I've got an S.
Italy.
Okay.
So that's two for Italy.
I've got S. Three for...
Three for Italy.
N.
N is Austria.
Ooh. So I've got Spain, Austria and Italy.
I've got M.
Ooh. That's Portugal.
Ooh. Portugal, okay. Slovenia. Portugal, Slovenia or Slovakia?
Slovakia.
And Italy. And then I've got a U.
Ooh, it's mixing it up. That's France.
That's your sweet France.
It's a good mix.
So we don't have any Greek notes. We're okay should Greek leave and return to the drachma. Although, actually, will it make any difference anyway?
No, because there was this suggestion. This is where this came about, this blog, 3 years ago. There was this suggestion from a travel cash company that people might want to watch out for the Greek ones because they might suddenly be cancelled. But if you think about the logistics of that, that would be almost impossible. How are you going to go round a continent that has a common currency and start just removing the Greek ones? Because they won't just be owned by Greeks. They'll be owned by French people and Italians and Spanish. And that kind of wallet inspection is not going to be very popular, is it? And also, they've changed the system as well. The new system for these new Europa series of euros actually just prints the... it has the letter, but the letter doesn't identify the bank that issued it. It identifies where it was printed. So you could get yourself a British one. If you have a J or an H on a new euro, it will have been printed by De La Rue in either Gateshead, which is the J, or Loughton for the H, which led me to joke that when we adopted the euro, were we going to split into two countries, the North and the South?
Hi, I'm Ed Bauscher, Share Radio's senior analyst and personal finance expert. My job is to explain the big financial issues in a simple, easy-to-understand way, and I do that across a range of different Share Radio shows. In the mornings, I chat with Georgie Frost about things like bank accounts, insurance, and sometimes the euro. And in the evenings, I talk about what's happened on the stock market in The Market Wrap with Simon Rose.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.
Pure Radio Gold in the studio can keep you entertained on family trips to France for hours. Check where your euro notes come from. All the information on This Is Money, the award-winning finance section of The Mail Online. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce, join me in the studio coming up. Hope for savers and why it's still worth haggling when buying a home. But first, pensions back on the agenda with some gusto, just as we're getting our heads, or not, around the new pension freedoms brought in a couple of months ago, where the over 55s can dig into their pot as they like. Now, there's another change on the horizon. Next April, we'll see the introduction of the single-tier state pension, an attempt, the government say, to simplify the current system. But in order to qualify, you'll need to work five more years than is what's currently required, but not all hope is lost. So, Lee, talk us through, if you would, this new single-tier pension, how it works. Please, main changes.
Do you know what? Simon would be better off handling this.
All right, just testing you there, Lee.
This is because, actually, whilst this is meant to simplify the system, it is actually fiendishly complicated.
Oh, Lee, you've just thrown him a curveball there. That's the real reason, isn't it? I don't want to talk about this.
I was asked, where this story came from, is it's an Ask an Expert question. How many years of national insurance do I need for the new flat rate state pension, and can I buy extra credits? And I was actually asked this question by a reader last weekend when we did the retirement money show. And I was on a stand there with one of my colleagues, and she came up and asked me the question. I said, you know what, I'll find out for you and we'll publish the answer. And the answer turned out to be not quite as simple as you'd think it would be. So part of the answer is simple and part of it gets ridiculously complicated.
Well, do your best,
easy
Simon.
Bit is that you need 35 years to qualify for the new flat rate state pension. And you need to have paid national insurance for 35 years. Under the current system for the basic state pension, you only need 30 years. The new state pension comes in April 2016, and we don't know exactly how much it's going to be yet, but the government have said it will be no less than £151.25 a week. So far, so simple. If you don't have enough years, you can buy extra years, basically, which actually, normally for most people, turns out to be quite a good deal, because the more years you have, the more pension you get, and the return on buying those years is pretty good. But where it starts to become really complicated is with this element of the additional pension benefit that you get, and this is the state second pension, or SERPs is the other thing that it used to be known as. And what this was people who had final salary or work pension schemes could contract out of paying extra national insurance to get this additional benefit. And by doing so, they essentially gave up some of their state pension on the basis that they were going to get work pension in return. And once you start factoring that into it, it turns out that this system isn't very simple at all, and it's really confusing for people to work out how much pension they've accrued.
What are the government, what are HMRC saying about this? Because I thought the whole point of this was to make it much simpler.
The point is to make it much simpler, and it will be much simpler for anybody who is basically paying national insurance after April 2016. Unfortunately, all the people who are paying national insurance after April 2016 aren't paying it yet. And those people who are going to be collecting their pension off the back of payments made after April 2016 aren't going to be retiring for a very long time. Mm. So you've got this weird hybrid system where they try and work it out. And this has actually thrown up a lot of other questions from readers about this element of the additional pension, the state second pension being contracted out. How much are they going to lose from it? Are they going to end up worse off? And people shouldn't end up worse off, because what will happen is there is this system that will calculate it. And if you've got the qualifying years, then you shouldn't end up losing money that you would have otherwise got. But we have got Mark working on an answer to that question right now as we speak, to try and explain that whole contracting out bit. The problem is you can go get a state pension projection from the government, but I don't think that a lot of people who are going to be affected by this can actually get those proper projections yet as we speak. So they're still working on it, basically.
How has it been received by your readers? You touched on it there.
By our readers, it has generally been received as, I thought this was meant to simplify stuff. This is ridiculously complicated. I mean, the idea of the flat rate state pension is a good one because it's trying to take this system that is very, very confused and turn it into just one simple, this is what you get. And if you don't have the qualifying years, you then just get a percentage of that flat rate amount. But you can see from all this confusion surrounding state second pensions and SERPs and additional benefit that it, you know, dealing with that stuff is very difficult for people.
In terms of paying extra national insurance contributions affecting many women, for example, taking time out to have children, welcome that you can do something, but how much are we really talking about here? And what's the return going to be on it?
I don't know the exact return, but so basically, at the moment, so this isn't for the new system, you can buy an extra year of pension for £733.20. That cost can change each year, basically. So it might be a different amount, you know, in the next tax year. But the return on that is basically throughout the rest of your life, if you live for 20 years, the return on that is actually pretty good. So for, I've got here, after April 2016, each extra year that you purchased would be worth about £225 a year in pension income. So for people who are in the situation where they have less years because they didn't work for a number of years or something, and if they do have the money to go buy those extra years, then it does often actually pay off.
So what's the advice then between now and when they come in next April? What should you do?
What you should do, if this affects you and you're one of those people who falls across the two systems, especially if you're in the years running up to your state pension age, is you should go to gov.uk where there is a state pension calculator, and you can use that to try and work out your own personal situation.
It all comes, let's stick with pensions, shall we, as an official study, Tanya Jeffries, your pensions expert, has been looking into this, shows that the majority of British people fear ending up with too little money for a comfortable old age and expect to work longer and retire later anyway. So the Office for National Statistics found almost 60% of the 20,000 adults they spoke to said they were either not very or not at all confident they'd have a big enough income to maintain the standard of living that they had hoped for in retirement. Little bit depressing. Lee, as our youngest member in the studio, what are your thoughts to this?
This study is very interesting, and there's a lot of, 20,000 people is a big pool to be sort of surveying. The one thing I would say about this, it doesn't give any indication if they've sort of targeted a certain age group or whatever. So, you know, older people are obviously going to have a lot sort of probably better feelings than younger people, you'd suspect. So, you know, as a younger person, it is a little bit scary to think about what age you're going to retire. I mean, some people in the survey, you know, the majority of people believe that they'll retire between 65 and 69. That's the sort of main age group on here. But some people, you know, there's a good 10% more that believe they'll be over 70. And even some people, about 5% of people, believe they're going to be over 75 when they retire. So it's a longer working life now that people are getting. But I guess the one thing I would say is that jobs are probably not quite as strenuous and difficult as they once were, sort of 50 years ago, for example. So we're all living longer, but perhaps not working as hard, depending on what industry you're in. But the stats are really interesting. One thing that really stands out is about which option do you think would make the most of your money, so for retirement? And nearly half of people said property. You know, looking at the last couple of years, house prices have rocketed, but if this survey was a few years ago, the answers might have been completely different, because we're on a feel-good factor of property at the moment, and people are getting into buy-to-let and seeing that as a sort of safer, I mean, people believe it's going to be a better place for their money than their employer pension,
which is interesting. Simon, you've spoken about this in the past, haven't you?
Yeah, it's you know, basically the reason why people have made so much money off buy-to-let over the last 20 years is because 20 years ago houses were cheap, and they're not cheap anymore, they're quite expensive. What I love about those statistics of which options do you think would make the most of your money is that there's about 2 or 3% of people who've said premium bonds. I mean, I like the idea that people are going to try and retire off the back of the premium bonds. It's quite interesting, though, isn't it? This sort of, like, when do you think you're going to retire kind of thing. Because, like, the what age would you retire at? Because there's, like, you get it a lot when you speak to people who are you know, retiring or at that run-up to retirement who actually say, I don't want to retire.
Yeah.
I want to keep working. I've actually realised that I always thought, yeah, I'm going to retire at, you know, 63 or 65 or something. And they get there and they think, actually, do you know what? I want to keep working. So, you know, it's but whereas if you ask someone who was 35, what age do you want to retire? They'd probably be saying 40.
That's what I was wondering. 40, yeah. And also, I'd imagine it depends what job you do and whether you enjoy your job. A lot of people would be quite depressed by this. But it's interestingly, you said there about greater public confidence in workplace when it comes to workplace pension schemes.
Yeah, well, it's a real broad mix of answers after property when you're looking at what you're going to make most of your money. But I would have thought pension would be, you know, sort of number one. Surely that's what people must be thinking. They're paying into their employer pension. There's usually very good deals. You know, you pay in certain percent, company pays certain percent on top, and they usually perform, you know, fairly well. So I think it's actually a little bit worrying that people are saying property over employer pension. I think it needs to be the other way around. But, you know, people, as I say, I don't know the age group really of who this is sort of being targeted at. If there was a lot of people that were sort of in their 60s that are answering these, I bet they're saying property rather than employer pension. So it's very difficult, unless you have a breakdown of the age groups that are answering these questions. It's very hard to sort of gauge an accurate.
What is quite cheering, I suppose, the awareness of the government's auto-enrolment initiative, which is good for young people, I suppose, in getting them thinking about saving for
certainly,
their retirement.
I think auto-enrollment's been very good, actually, because there's a lot of people out there that are in their 20s who, you know, have just started working or starting careers and not thinking about the long-term future. You're not thinking about when you're going to retire in your 60s, when you're in your mid-20s, wanting to go on holidays and saving up for a home and all of those sort of things. So to actually put someone into an auto-enrollment scheme and making them pay for their pension, I think it's actually a very good idea, and it's I think it's been pretty well received. And
at least it gets the ball rolling, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly.
And I've spoken about this before, this trick where if you save for 30 years and get a sort of 6% return on your investments versus 40 years, 40 years will actually double your money. And so that extra 10 years really pays off. And so at least it gets people in their 20s putting some money in. But, I mean, the thing that people do need to be wary of with auto-enrolment is that it is only a small amount that they're putting in. And yes, their employer's contributing some and they're getting the tax relief. But you won't probably get the retirement you're hoping for just off the back of auto-enrolment. You need to put a bit more effort in than that.
Indeed. 2% of your salary at the moment is the total minimum. That's going to rise to 8% in 2018. What is the figure that we're actually looking at that we really should be thinking about saving? I know it's individually, it's to each different person, but what are some of the figures that have been mentioned?
There's various different rules of thumb that crop up, but one of the numbers that generally gets bandied around is 15% of your income. You need to be saving 15% of your income, which, you know, if you're lucky and you've got an employer who will match a decent amount of your contributions. So say a lot of people have a system where if they put in up to five, their employer will match up to five. So they could put in more, but their employer will only match up to five. So that would be 10% going in there. So that's a pretty good start already. Then if you can save another 5%, you're doing well. And you don't necessarily have to be saving that other 5% into a pension. Maybe you might want to save that 5%, save it into a savings account build a rainy day fund, then invest it into an ISA, something simple like stock market tracker. We ran a poll actually on our readers to ask them when they thought they were going to be retiring. They appear to be quite a lot more optimistic than the ones surveyed here. So we've got our answers were, what age do you expect to stop working at? And it's before I'm 55, before I'm 60, 60 to 62, 63 to 65, 66 to 70. I don't think I will. 42% of people reckon they're retiring before 60. That's 21% saying they're retiring before 55, and the other 21% saying they're retiring before 60. Then we've got another 19% who maintain they're retiring before 62. So that, once you add all that up, that's 61% of people who think they're retiring before 62. And only 10% of people said they don't think they ever will retire.
Wow. I want a figure from you, Simon.
I would like to stop working full-time at 60.
The real answer to that was you would never like to stop working at This Is Money. However...
No, but do you know what? I like the idea of once my kids have grown up and they've left home and they've gone to university and they're out of my hair, I like the idea of maybe going and doing something different, you know, enjoying myself. Do you know what? I want to move to a ski resort. I'm going to move to the mountains, go snowboarding and skiing each day, do what I really want to do.
Lee, yourself?
I've never really thought about it, but probably, you know, mid-60s, buy a yacht, just go sail around the Med, have a few cigars, a couple of bottles of vodka on board. That's my retirement plans right there.
Not really thought about it very much, but you've come up with a very good answer to that.
You notice there's no food on this yacht.
I'm fishing.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Now, before we move away from pensions, we've spoken about paying for financial advice last week, how the best age apparently to get it is 25. But with the pension freedoms, lots of us thinking about going to the professionals. But of course, it's expensive. And one company think they have the answer. They spotted a gap in the industry for confused retirees. Now, Hargreaves Lansdown are offering a new low-cost pension planning service for a flat rate fee of £395 plus VAT, so a total of £475. £4, a halfway house, they say, between the government's free PensionWise service and formal financial advice, as they will not be offering specific personal recommendations. Well, earlier I spoke to personal finance expert and founder of boringmoney.co.uk, Holly Mackay, who's contributed to This Is Money in the past, to get her thoughts.
There's a real gap in the market here because, of course, traditional financial advisors, you'll go and see one, and typically you'll pay, say, 3% up front for them to look at your portfolio and about 1% every year for them to manage it thereafter. Now, lots of people are saying, actually, I'm not sure I need ongoing advice. This pensions thing's quite complicated. I'd like someone to sort of help me and make sure I don't do something daft. Mm. But do I want to pay 1% forever sort of going on? No, I don't. So I actually think the Hargreaves service fills a gap. I've got no doubt we'll see loads more people coming to market with this. And people like it. I mean, we like, I think, this percentage business. It's all really woolly. I think people like seeing it's almost like sort of someone slapping a price tag on it. And I think that's really welcome.
Well, that was personal finance expert and founder of boringmoney.co.uk, Holly Mackay, there saying that this is a good idea. Simon Lee, your views on this?
Well, so this isn't full-on, full-fat financial advice, and it's important to remember that. And that's why it's cheaper. But the
halfway
the cost,
house, they
it's
say.
A halfway house, yeah. But the cost of financial advice is quite difficult to pin down. But the general cost bandied around for sort of sorting out a £100,000 pension pot is about £1,500 to £2,000. So this would save you a lot of money. Now, what's interesting about this is that essentially what they will do is they'll explain your options about how you can get that income. They'll probably talk to you about all the things that you might not potentially think of. But there's probably a lot of people who think, well, this is just money for old rope. They're just charging me nearly 500 quid to tell me something I could do myself. And it remains to be seen because, you know, until you've been through the process, you won't really know. I mean, maybe we could try and road test it in some way to try and work out quite how good it is. But I think actually that's a bit unfair from some of the comments being made about this, saying, oh, it's just, you know, 500 quid, state the bleeding obvious. Mm. I actually think this service, like Holly says there, will probably fill a very big gap that needs to be filled, because there are a lot of people who are quite confused about this and about how to basically structure their pension in what's called the decumulation phase. So you've got the accumulation phase where you're saving your money, you retire, and then you're living off it, and that's called the decumulation phase. And people, even people who are successful investors in the accumulation phase, sometimes find it quite difficult to get their head around the decumulation phase. One of the things they find
so difficult. Why?
I don't know. One of the things people find it hard to get their head around is spending their money. It's this idea of I've got my pension pot, basically, so I need to live off the income off that, but I need to keep the pension pot intact. I don't want to eat into it. And it's like, well, no, actually, you've saved that pension pot to fund your retirement, so you should be spending some of the capital.
Problem is,
so
then it comes you don't up to know this, how long you're going to
exactly.
last, basically.
So they help you work out how long you think you might last and how you would go about getting income and spending some of the capital so that you don't suddenly run out of money really quickly, but also you're not living a much poorer retirement than you need to because you're desperately holding on to this pot that really you should be spending.
I'm going to stick with a bit of a cynical view of it before we do move on. I don't know, I've not road tested this at all, but before, when all these pension changes came in, we heard from a lot of firms saying they were worried about getting sued for giving bad advice. Is this a way of Hargreaves Lansdown, I'm sure others will follow suit, of protecting themselves because they're not actually offering you formal financial advice, but they're still coining in?
Yeah, but I mean, if you wanted proper financial advice, you could pay Hargreaves. Hargreaves do have advisors. You could pay them for proper financial advice. I think Hargreaves Hargreaves are the big boy of like DIY investing. They've really been the company that's capitalized on this whole trend towards moving, you know, onto the, you know, investing away from the old fashioned stockbroker fund management world to people doing it themselves. And people, names like Hargreaves Lansdown, names like the Share Center, like Best Invest, you know, like Fidelity, people recognize these names and they trust these names. So when they see these services, they think, yes, that could do it for me. Now, what you have to compare that to is we're saying to people, well, maybe you should go see a proper financial advisor. But going back to what I was saying about being asked questions by readers at this Retirement Money Show, some of the questions that were put to the panel that I was on was like, yes, you're saying go see a financial advisor, but where do I find these financial advisors? Lots of people don't trust financial advisors. They've been stung in the past by the old system where they used to be paid through commission. And they trust these big names more than they trust the individual financial advisor with an office on the high street.
Where does this leave the government's free advice service, pension-wise?
As the first place that you should go if you are someone who is approaching retirement and or over 55, going to benefit from pension freedom and thinking about taking your money out, they'll explain your options to you. So go there first and then think about where you go next.
How popular do you think, finally, before we move on, a scheme like this is going to be?
I think it'll prove, over time, very popular, and I think there'll be lots more companies. As Holly said, I think there'll be lots more companies that do it. And then the process will be, you know, sort of changed and honed. And I think that probably out of the back of this will come some kind of service that can definitely help people. And people should consider whether, rather than thinking, is this just money for old rope, they should be thinking, will I get a better retirement income off the back of getting some help? And spending £500 might get you an extra £500 every year for the rest of your life.
Well, from retirement to savings. Coming up, we'll be discussing the newest banking kid on the block. But first, it hasn't been rosy for savers over the last few years. Dismal interest rates, but finally there could be light at the end of the tunnel. According to your recent article featuring views from James Blower from the independent website The Savings Guru, it's all about the rise of new challenger banks competing for our hard-earned cash. Now, the latest challenger bank to rise up is Atom, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes. But first, Simon Lee, can you explain how more competition means better deals for savers? And Lee, what are James Blower's views on this?
So James used to be the head of savings at Shawbrook Bank, who are a challenger bank that launched a few years ago. And what's happening at the moment in the savings market, and it has done for quite a long time, is that the Best Buy This Is Money tables that I update on a daily basis are filled with challenger banks and not high street banks. Now, it's been a very sort of rocky 24 months for rates. There's not really hasn't been much in the way of movement. However, in the last sort of couple of months, there's been a few challenger banks, especially in the fixed rate bond market, that have come out as best buys. So this week, Charter Savings Bank, which got its license earlier on in the year, has got a 2-year rate, 1-year rate at 2%, which is the first time there's been a 1-year rate at 2% for 2 years. So it's showing it's going into a sort of north way. So what James was saying is that, number one, there's a lot of new challenger banks in the pipeline. And what that will mean is when they launch, they're going to have to be fairly competitive if they're offering savings rates, and they're going to need to fill their balance sheet. They're going to need to get savings to lend out, etc. Another marker that he said is that there was a Best Buy Easy Access account launched last week. Easy Access savings accounts, new launches have been honestly few and far between. And an Easy Access account is just a simple account people use, you know, just to squirrel a little bit of money away. Now, Lloyds has a brand called BM Savings, and they launched the Best Buy 1.5%, which is a bit of an unusual move considering Lloyds is a dominant force in the savings market. So it's obviously looking for some savings, and he thinks that's a good sign. He thinks that might mean that other banks might follow suit. And then thirdly, at the start of May, he was saying only four banks, and they were all foreign owned, were paying above 1.75% in the 1-year fixed rate market. Now they've been joined by five challengers, so five more different banks are now offering a rate over that. And as I just mentioned, Charter Savings have launched at 2%.
Simon, your views on this, especially with regard to interest rates as well? We are expecting them to rise, but that's not what's going to get us excited, because actually it rarely transfers onto it, our savings rates.
No, what you'll find is when interest rates rise, there'll then be this game that the banks and building societies play, where they decide how much of that raise they're going to pass on to savers and to borrowers. So how much they're going to raise their standard variable rates by, which are the sort of the default rates that people fall onto on their mortgages after their fixed term deal ends, and their sort of easy access savings rates. And what you generally tend to find is that when rates are going up, they will pass on the full rise to borrowers on their mortgage, but they won't pass on the full rise to savers in the returns they get. And when rates were going down, which we've had more recently, albeit an exceptionally long time ago now, because rates haven't moved since 2009, what you'd find is they'd pass on slightly less to borrowers in terms of a cut on their mortgages, but pass on the full amount to savers. But I think all these new banks are a great thing. I think this is really good news. I'd love to see more banks. What I like about this is that it seems to me that genuinely the FCA and the Bank of England have made it easier for new banks to set up. And there was a big problem highlighted very well by a friend of This Is Money, Dave Fishwick, of Bank of Dave fame, who tried to set up his own bank and realised he couldn't do it.
What have they done to make it easier? Why are we seeing this?
They've relaxed some of the rules around sort of funding and how much you need to get off the ground. It used to be, I think...
that was Dave's problem, wasn't it?
Exactly. And they've just sort of loosened up some of the regulatory stuff to be able to start a bank. Yeah, it's just 2 years ago they did it. And actually, there's meant to be sort of 35 new banks on the horizon from the back of this. It's a long-drawn process still. I mean, Atom Bank, we're going to talk about shortly. I mean, since last year, they've been talking about it. So it's not. It has to be a robust sort of system. Otherwise, anyone would be.
Well, that's the thing. That's what people must be listening, thinking. Oh, hang on. At a time when banks are doing all sorts of things, do we want to be loosening up regulations? Interesting, though, that Metro Bank, when it first came on, was the first new bank, I believe, on the high street for 100 years.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the interesting thing about this banking element is it's a real slow burn. It's going to take a long time before you start denting the giants of NatWest and Lloyds. But it's great to have all this competition at the bottom, and you know, someone signs up to one of these banks and they think they're good and they tell their mates about it, and then they sign up to it and it all grows, you know, and it all starts to make a difference. And even banks that have been around for quite some time are challengers and are doing quite well, and some of them are doing it quite quietly. There's this bank called Handelsbanken, which is Swedish. And it does this very low profile kind of very personal banking, doesn't advertise rates. You go in, discuss with them what the rate's going to be on your mortgage, and they then offer you a personalised rate and stuff. And I met up with Richard Winder of Handelsbanken the other week, and he was telling me a lot of this is through word of mouth. It's through customers who've had a good experience telling their friends or their colleagues or the people that they do business with, saying, yeah, this is a good idea. And there's one hidden away by our office, actually, on Kensington High Street. We never knew about it.
I spotted it a little while back, but we've been walking past it for a year, and it's so unassuming, you wouldn't even know it's there. That is how... it's almost like secretive banking.
Yeah, which stands in stark contrast to what we expect from our banks and their big, imposing buildings, which have now just been turned into vast, empty spaces with some cash machines against the wall and some people wandering around with a clipboard saying, can I help you? And then when you actually ask them to help you, they can't help you. They direct you either to a cash machine or to a colossal queue for the two cashiers who are actually working.
Let it go, Simon, let it go. Returning to the views of James Blow, though, he says he genuinely believes we've reached a turning point for the UK savings markets. But Lee, are we ever going to see a return to those heady days of 6% and 7%, he says?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't think that's going to happen. No, I don't think so. I mean, not in the near future anyway, because I mean, some of these 6-7% rates, I mean, we're not even talking a long time ago, but saying it just sounds so weird because it sounds so high. But he believes that it's going to be a slow sort of recovery in the savings market, and he reckons we're several years away from 1 year rates of 3-4%. So we'll wait and see. But hopefully, you know, he's outlined a couple of really good points there about why he believes it's the bottom. Let's hope it is.
Well, sticking with savings and banks, and could we soon be saying a final farewell to bank branches with the launch of a new online-only bank, Atom Bank, which will use mobile apps for its current accounts, mortgages and personal loans. It's been given the go-ahead by regulators and is set to start launching products later this year. It's the brainchild of Anthony Thompson. One of the people behind Metro Bank and its chief exec is Mark Mullen, the former boss at First Direct. Already set some pretty ambitious targets, saying they plan on having having 5 million current accounts by 2020, or 5% slice of the UK market. Well, Anthony Thompson spoke exclusively to Share Radio about what makes Atom Bank different from the rest.
Atom's about creating something of its time. It's a bank for the future. In fact, we talk internally about, we captured a little phrase, that Atom is established in the future. It's not a bank of today, it's a bank of tomorrow. With data technology and predictive technologies. So that I know, for example, in August, when you go on holiday, when your car insurance comes up for renewal and your household insurance comes up for renewal, that maybe your outgoings for that month will be more than your income. Mm. So we can tell you in advance, look, you might have this problem, you might not, but if you do, here's a temporary facility to help you go through that. So that is about telepathic banking. It's about knowing what you need from your bank. What we want to do is reduce the cost of your banking. And there are two big parts to that. One is people. People are very expensive. And the second is location. So if we can enable you to do everything you need to do on your mobile device, frankly, just with your thumb, and take away the need for lots and lots of people, lots and lots of expensive real estate, we can give you fantastic value products and we can give you great service. Because guess what? The best customer service satisfaction scores anybody gets is from customers who self-serve.
Chairman of Atom Bank, founder Anthony Thompson, there speaking to Share Radio. He's one of the people behind Metro Bank, previous venture there. Very different, I think, in terms of values, customer service. I spoke to Share Radio's personal finance expert, Ed Boucher, about this.
Only 5 years ago, when Metro Bank was launched, people were saying, well, look, why are you opening all these branches? Branches are history. And Metro Bank said, no, 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 we think branches are going to stay important. 5 years later, the same chap's launching Atom Bank, and he's suddenly saying, well, we don't need branches. So that's an interesting change.
It is an interesting change indeed, giggling along there. What do you make of those?
Well, it is the direct opposite of Metro Bank. Metro Bank was all based on full fat service, open 7 days a week, properties on the high streets and, you know, in and around London in the M25, so that's expensive stuff. Whereas Atom Bank is all about doing it on the phone in your pocket. To be honest, if I had to choose which one I'd go for the phone in my pocket option. But that can't do all the things that you necessarily want it to. It can't necessarily do the small business banking that you might need, the bit where you need a relationship with a bank manager to help make the decisions on your lending. But, you know, I think this Atom Bank idea is a good idea. And I'm not the only person. There's a rather famous investor called Neil Woodford who's put some money into it as well. He's backed it.
He
obviously
indeed.
Thinks it's a good idea.
I'm just curious, though, about a mortgage on a mobile app, Lee?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that's going to work, but I would have thought that you would more likely go through the call centre, because there's still going to be a call centre, of course. It's not just going to be via, I don't think you're going to be able to get a mortgage via app. I mean, that would be pretty mad. But I've met Anthony a few times over the years, and, you know, they've got Mark Mullen, chief exec, who was of First Direct. And First Direct tops opinion polls all the time. So if he can work some of that magic at Atom Bank, it's got Anthony behind it as well, who's obviously very smart and knows what people want. You know, Metro Bank has been a success. I think it's just great to see all of these new challenges come into the market. And, you know, all right, 5 million current accounts by 2020 is about as ambitious as you can probably go. But I think it's going to attract a certain generation of people.
They're making it very clear, aren't they? They're appealing to the 18 to 34-year-olds.
Exactly.
They've said that.
But I don't think it's going to be exclusive to that. I mean, you know, my mum uses a tablet. I mean, I think it's a bit of a sort of stereotype around it, but lots of older people will use tablets and mobiles, and I'm sure that they'd be interested in Atom Bank. But, yeah, I mean, it's going to appeal to a certain kind of person. And as he says, he's promised, I spoke to him earlier in the year, and he promised top savings rates because the overheads are going to be low because it has no high street presence. And sometimes banks can spend a couple of million quid just kitting out one branch. So you can see why banks are starting to close the branches. They're realising that it's an expensive burden.
Interesting to see how those rates do end up comparing, won't it?
Exactly.
You know, because if you think about it, it's true. You are saving an awful lot of money by not having all those branches. And it's good to have the choice as well, isn't it? It's good to have, you know, you can have a small bank and you can either go with the one that's just in your pocket on your mobile phone at the Atom Bank, or you can go down to Metro and have that complete immersive experience with some free biscuits for your dog. Versus actually our big banks, they're all kind of the same, aren't they, really? Barclays, Halifax, you know, NatWest, Nationwide even, which is a building society. It's all kind of the same stuff, just packaged slightly different, isn't it? Whereas these are two things that are genuinely completely different to each other.
Also, they're able to save money, you say, by not having branches, but also the amount of money that the big banks are spending. We mentioned it before in the past on their old tech that they've got. And we saw that with RBS glitch.
It's just layers on layers of old systems. So it's really
just sucking money from banks.
It must be costing them an absolute fortune to be keeping up to trying to keep it all up to date. And to say last week RBS had that sort of meltdown, and people just creates some, you know, mistrust. If your money could disappear or payments are disappearing, it's kind of frightening. Okay, it's all being sorted now and the issue's been ironed out, but it makes people probably want to go, well, look, this is a fresh brand new bank that's got systems that it's built from scratch from the word go, so it should be clean, it should have no problems, you'd suspect. If it did have a meltdown, then I don't know how people would react.
I think people would be quite worried if they understood more about money anyway. If they understood that when they took out a mortgage, the bank didn't actually take £200,000 that it had in its bank account and then transfer it to you. All that happened is someone on a computer just typed £200,000 next to your name into a computer and the bank's just created £200,000. I think people, if they thought about that kind of stuff, might get quite a lot more worried than they are. Because if you could do that, you could delete it as well.
You can indeed. Well, let's turn our attention away from this and our final story in Property Hunters, finding haggling over house prices harder with the average home carrying a reduction of just 6% from its original listing. That's according to the property website Zoopla, who say it's the smallest wiggle room for buyers we've seen since 2010. But you've been talking to buying agent Henry Pryor, who says, well, it's still worth a go, isn't it? Tell us a little bit more about what's happening.
Well, this research comes out sort of once a month, and I think what's happening is people are listing their homes for quite a lot of money, especially in like places like London, and just chancing their arm, really, because obviously there's been a bit of a property boom. But people seem to be paying the prices for it. And, you know, they're not being able to haggle much money off the list price. And it's just, I think the biggest problem is demand is, you know, outstripping supply. There's not actually, I've been house hunting and there's just, in the areas I want to buy in, there's hardly anything going. And you're fighting people to sort of look at properties in the best spot. And people are willing to meet the asking price at the moment for the home they want. I spoke to Henry, who's, you know, an expert in all these things. And his number one tip was, but don't be afraid to make an offer. You know, even if you don't end up getting that home, if you've got to start a little bit lower than what's being listed. Because, as I say, people are thinking to themselves, you know, it's a strong market at the moment. I'm going to put my house up for sale, probably £20,000 more than it should go up for. And a lot of this is London and the South East, by the way. You should say that. But people are just willing to pay it. So
outside London and the South East, though, you've also looked into that?
Well, this is what Zoopla's saying, actually, because the areas with the highest proportion of asking price reduction, so places where you can haggle yourself a discount.
And it's worth noting that these aren't, you know, this isn't what people offer off the asking price. Mm. This is basically the property's been listed at a higher price once, and then that listing price has had to be cut because they're obviously not getting enough people in the door and they're not getting any offers. So they've cut that asking price.
All the ones that have been cut are in towns in the north. So that's where, if you want to go and haggle, if you're looking for a cheaper property that's had a reduction over the last sort of year or so, go to Rotherham. You get yourself
there
a bargain
you go.
Up there.
Go to Rotherham, you've heard it here first. Also, go to This Is Money. Four tips from Henry Pryor on there, but my favourite is, you are not trying to make friends, you are trying to buy a home.
It's a good one. The tip I'd give is find out why those people are selling. Work out who that seller is and what their motivation is. Because if they've already found somewhere to buy, then there'll be a price that they need to get to. And yeah, always make an offer. Make lots of offers. You know, you'll eventually buy a house, but you might get lucky and it's the first one you see and you make an offer on. But actually, maybe you might have to make an offer on 10.
Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning finance section of the Mail Online. Thank you so much for joining us. Share Radio.